Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Conversations On, where the YMCA of the North engages with local and national leaders about their experiences, their insights, and their aspirations. I'm Rashini Rajkumar. Today, CEO Glenn Gunderson chats with Dr. Courtney Beckler, Medical Director of Health Equity and Health Promotion at Minneapolis Heart Institute Foundation. Find out why she's living the activist life in health and wellness, starting with her roots at the Y as a kid.
Well, Courtney Jordan Beckler, it is so great to have you in studio. I've been a long admirer of your leadership, and so thanks for joining today.
Thanks, Glenn. Glad to be here, and definitely the admiration is mutual for sure.
That sounds great. So tell me a little bit about your childhood. Let's start and go way back. You grew up in Apple Valley, Minnesota. So what was childhood like?
I did, but, you know, I was thinking about this in preparation for this conversation, and, you know, I grew up as a Y kid, so it's kind of, it's really fitting. I grew up in an interracial family. My father's African American, my mom is white, and my brother and sister and I were all adopted, and my mom had a career at the YMCA, as you know, before you started, and I really followed her each summer, whatever YMCA she was at for childcare. So I started at the Hiawatha Y, and then moved over to the Blaisdell YMCA, and really spent as a Y summer in the cities kid, and it was just such a great experience. I think I look back on those times so fondly, having grown up in the suburbs, just with so much more exposure to what life is like in a variety of settings and places.
That's great. I mean, talk about the Y, kind of building strong kids and resilience. Yeah. And so we want to take a little credit for all your success in life that
Absolutely.
The Y made a small role. So yeah. We've been in an interesting place around race for decades and decades in this community, but in particular in the last couple of years. And so I'm going to get right into this as well. How did race show up for you as a young person? And how has it been for you as an adult?
Yeah, I think it's been really interesting for me. Again, growing up in an interracial family, I'm Persian myself, and my brother and sister both have very unique backgrounds also. And it just was kind of how it always was. And my parents didn't spend a lot of time dwelling on the fact that they were one of very few interracial couples in Apple Valley at the time. And specifically, I remember there were so few kids of color on my brother's football team, for instance, that everyone always assumed that my dad was their father, you know? And so it would show up in weird ways that way, but they always just skipped through that. You know, it wasn't ever really focused on that way. But when I was in high school, we started to see it a little bit more. And so this is in the 90s. This is not that long ago. And my dad was looking at jobs in Kentucky at this time, and they didn't allow interracial couples to live in certain areas then. And so at that time, he was commuting back and forth for his job because they couldn't live as the couple that they were in one of the states in the U.S. at the time. And so I started to see it that way. He was commissioner of public safety for a while under Governor Carlson. And there were times that we got racial threats. And I remember that again in high school. And it was such a interesting and surprise, I guess, because I think so much of that happened but was hidden from me when I was younger. So I started to really kind of awaken up to what life really was like at that time. And again, I would contrast that with my experiences at the YMCA throughout the year, but more heavily in the summer when I wasn't in school, where we just all hung out, right? Like we all enjoyed the same types of things, going on field trips and hanging out. This was pre the renovation of the Blaisdell Y, and just being outside. And, you know, I learned how to swim there, and you learned how to swim with everybody. You know, it didn't matter what color you were or anything that way. So it was a pretty interesting realization, I think. And then I went to school in California, and I was shocked at how actually racially segregated California felt compared to Minnesota. I saw for the first time other Persian people, but was so excited to meet other Persian people, and was kind of sort of not met with excitement in that I didn't know more about the Persian culture because I had grown up in such a mixed race family. So it was very interesting. And then as a physician now, you know, it shows up all the time and has been a big part since medical school, when it was my second year of medical school, when I first learned about the tremendous, horrible racial disparities that we have. That just as a math major really didn't make sense scientifically, and started to kind of put this whole puzzle together for me based on my background and then also my career interests.
I've followed your career, and of course you've served the board a couple of times with the Y, mm-hmm. and currently serve on the Y board. And I've been so interested in you, not only from a clinical perspective, but from a social outreach and impact on community more broadly. And you took on a state role. It's interesting. I didn't know that history about your dad being involved in state government. So is that what led you to a role like that? Maybe emulating a lesson or a leadership style you saw in the past, and share a little bit about your work with the state and your goals around health equity, and maybe share where are we in this health equity equation right now in our community?
Yeah. Well, we have a long way to go. So I guess just to back up, definitely. I think for me, I'm always trying to figure out, with the tools, skill sets, interests that I have, how can I have the biggest impact? During my medical training, my intern year sort of started to recognize the social determinants of health, which we weren't taught a lot about in medical school, and realized, you know, what we do in the clinic and in the hospital is critical, but it's pretty down the line in terms of looking at things more upstream and from a population health. And, you know, ultimately 80% of health outcomes are not determined by what's done in the clinical setting. So it spurred my interest in doing more from a public health perspective. And certainly I did, I think both of my parents as servant leaders, but specifically my dad serving in that role had led me to that a little bit, though he definitely gave me a lot of warning of, you know, you're sort of want to get things done fast, and things are designed to not move fast in government. And so keep that in mind. So I served as assistant commissioner for public health with Commissioner Malcolm in January of 2019 to 2020. And in that role, oversaw health equity for the state. And again, I think it just emphasized that much more these health disparities that we have. And when we think about cardiovascular disease, I'm a cardiologist. It continues to be the leading cause of death for every race and sex, but disproportionately so highest for women of color and American Indian women. So as a woman, as somebody who grew up in a diverse family, this is just, you know, there's so much more work that needs to be done there. We have the best outcomes in the entire country for white people as it relates to heart disease. And we have since 1999, but we do not see that same reality for our people of color. So and really, things have changed very minimal in the last 40 or 50 years, where perhaps we've been starting to have at least somewhat more of a lens to this. So it definitely has been a huge part of my interest. So for me at the Department of Health, I think there's such great opportunities still at the state level, but I had a unique opportunity with the Heart Institute and Heart Institute Foundation to really dive specifically into my expertise in cardiovascular disease and how we engage differently with communities. So it just was too great of an opportunity to pass up.
Hmm. Yeah, I certainly appreciate your work at the state, and you kind of escaped just before Jan and the team had to really focus deeply on the pandemic, right? And then came back into the Heart Institute, and I'm so grateful for your work there as well. And you continue to reach out to community. And as we think about our community here in the Twin Cities, I mean, what an amazing few years we've been, you know, we've been living. And I'm curious your thoughts, you know, as George Floyd was murdered, as the summer of 20 unfolded, where were your heart and head at that time? And where do you think we are now?
Yeah, so it's interesting. We have population health interns from the School of Public Health every year, and my intern last year, Delaine Thomas, who's amazing, walked from our headquarters at 28th in Chicago to where George Floyd was murdered. You know, and it's about 10,000 steps from one of the leading heart hospitals in the state and in the country. And the irony of all of that, and just the whole situation. And so, you know, I'm grateful that we had started a partnership prior to George Floyd's murder with Insight News, one of the longstanding Black newspapers that Al McFarland started on the North Side. His daughter, Batala McFarland, had reached out at the time when I was at the Department of Health and said, hey, I think we can kind of look at health differently here. And let's start doing things differently. Let's start letting the community really lead this, which has been really difficult for healthcare when we're so used to being in the driver's seat. And so we had partnered prior to that. After George Floyd's murder, things really got accelerated, and it's tragic, horrible, everything that we can possibly think of that it takes another murder of a Black man to have this happen. But we do see, as we come up on the second year anniversary of his murder, his legacy. And it really, in that regard, opened, I think, eyes wider at our headquarters to the disparities that we see right there. Just as, again, we're 10 blocks from his murder, a very diverse neighborhood, and the population, and when we look at the patients that we see, 3% of the patients that we see in cardiovascular disease are people of color, which does not meet with representatively of what we have in the Twin Cities. So we know we have so much work to do with trust, with recognizing historical trauma, with reaching out and being actually active in the community and not just sort of, hey, we're over here, you know? And so we're over the last 2 years, really doing that differently, partnering with all sorts of organizations, hearing stories from community members who've been most impacted by these disparities on what this looks like, and having that curb how we do our research, how we do our clinical outreach. And so it's exciting times. It's sad that it had to be accelerated by George Floyd's murder.
Yeah, you know, it's really exciting times over there at Chicago and Lake and just to the north with a really major investment that's going to go into that area and into the hospital and all things surrounding it. I imagine that's going to impact the Heart Institute. Would you, what is driving that percentage you shared earlier? You know, the very low percentage of people of color we're serving in those instances. Is it an access thing? Would you just talk a little further? What do you believe the elements are as to why? And then what are some of the solutions?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of different factors going into this. When we look at what happened in the pandemic and sort of who, again, had access to COVID care, and then who had access and trust in vaccines, I think you see a mirror of what we see in cardiovascular disease. Unfortunately, you know, the Tuskegee trials, which most people know about and have heard about, were not a long time ago. And when we look at data, still in the 1990s, at large academic institutions, you still see people of color being used inappropriately, inhumanely in studies in the 90s. So this is real. This is recent. I think that when you look at when Medicare first passed, only half of people of color were eligible for Medicare. So as you and I both know, as people who are probably fairly well insured and have had access, It is complicated to use healthcare. And now you're looking at a condensed time, lack of trust, again, like appropriately so. And then unfortunately, when you look at where clinics are and where hospitals are, they're not often, now granted Abbott is, you know, but they're not often in places that need them most, and particularly preventative care, outpatient settings, things like that. You know, the North Side has a few amazing clinics like North Point Clinic, but you look at Edina and look at France Avenue, and, you know, at one point in time, there were more CT scanners on France Avenue than there were in Canada, was one of the statistics I had heard. So we definitely, where resources exist, are disproportionate. And then, unfortunately, again, when we look at our own Minnesota statistics, when we look at things that impact health, like poverty, like home ownership, those also disproportionately impact our populations of color. So many things that ultimately gives you the time, autonomy, access, all the and trust to seek healthcare. Is really set up not in a good way. It wasn't designed for people of color. But I would emphasize that the other thing that we know is even when we correct for education and income, there are still disparities. So we absolutely know that structural racism is very much a part of this, and it has to be part of the way that we dismantle and figure out the solution going forward.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And I really appreciate that history lesson, too, that you share, which is so recent, right? We're not talking about hundreds of years ago or decades and decades, right. But even in the last 20 or 30 years, we've still had these systems, and unwinding that is such a challenging thing across all of government and across healthcare, et cetera. Well, and our community has really, you know, found its way to resilience. I mean, with the pandemic, with the racial unrest, and you have been a model for me in so many ways, Courtney. And one of those has been your resilience coming through tragedy and coming through the loss of your daughter. And I wonder if you share, you had a powerful reflection after, and you know, kind of this commitment to you are going to thrive, right? And would you share a bit about how that shaped you and how it's changed you?
So my daughter Sophia passed away in 2015 unexpectedly, and as everyone can imagine, your worst fear and all of those things that, you know, you sort of have these conversations. Can you imagine? What would you do? And I think all of us kind of instinctively say, I wouldn't get up the next day. And she passed on a Sunday night, got home super, super late. And my son, who was 5 at the time and was with us when she died, woke up the next day at 9, just slightly late for school, and said, did I miss the bus? And I just remember thinking, oh, wait, what? Isn't he putting together what happened? And is this, you know, and I remember right there kind of thinking, okay, like this is gonna have to be, he deserves a happy life full of joy, obviously with sadness that went with the death of his sister, but we have to step forward. And there I was in my pajamas dropping him off at school, running through, you know, whatever fast option there was for breakfast. And I remember just thinking it's going to be one step in front of the other, and then really being very purposeful in taking care of myself so that I could show up, you know, in every, super thankful that at the time I was working for the Penny George Institute for Health and Healing, where we really focus on how you bring your best, healthiest, thriving self forward. So I had a lot of those building blocks to think about what I was eating, how I was moving, you know, what integrative ways there were to help heal, which definitely was a big part of my journey. But for me, that then, you know, translated into what I do with my career, how I spend my time going forward, to kind of think you never know how long we have, and to really cherish these moments and make it meaningful. So it is, it is always a journey. I was just talking to a friend who was going through a hard time, and she was saying to her husband, I feel like I need a little Courtney. She always sees, you know, the bright side. And I don't know that that is always true. You know, there's days where I don't, but I think that there usually is a rainbow out of after a bad storm. And I definitely try to look for those rainbows on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, statistically or from a neurological perspective, we know that if we think about what we are grateful for, things look different. We can actually rewire our brain that way. So it's a process, but thankful for our friends, family, and lots of putting all that integrative health to practice after the death of Sophia.
Yeah, well, amazing resilience and your leadership and your role modeling for us as we all deal with trauma at some point, and such a challenging storm to come through. And I love your rainbow analogy, right? Yeah. That there is always hope on the other side. I'm curious, as you think about this integrative well-being and this element that helped you kind of process and move through that storm. You know, at the Y, we're really interested in moving from this swim gym perception in the community to whole person well-being. And the Georges, you mentioned the Penny George Institute, have been immensely supportive and continue to be in helping us kind of reshape. But would you talk about what is whole person well-being to you, and how we talked about access earlier, and, you know, challenging even to get some of the most basic capabilities and services from a health perspective to some in our community. But I'm curious, how do you define whole person well-being? And do you see that as an important frontier for the why?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so I really think about whole person well-being as body, mind, and spirit, and collectively trying to optimize all of that. So you really are in the best place to thrive. Sometimes that means optimizing all of that with cancer. You know, sometimes there's things that we can't cure, but we can have a different whole health opportunity for ourselves that feels different than when you're just kind of barely making it by. I also think in medicine, and I can't tell you how many times I say this to patients, you know, people come in with something, heart palpitations, which I've seen more than I ever have during this pandemic. And they feel their heart beating irregular. We do all sorts of tests to look basically if it's something that's going to kill you. And then we're left with, well, good news, your heart's okay. But the person still feels this symptom of palpitations. And for me, that's so much of where whole person health comes in, is your body is sending you a signal that you don't feel well, that you are not thriving. And Western medicine often doesn't have a solution for that. Or maybe you don't feel like you want to be on a pill and you don't have to be, or, you know, there's this room for conversation. And that's where I think helping your body heal in other ways. For me, acupuncture was a big part of processing Sophia's death afterwards, when I felt like I wasn't aligned body and mind and spirit, but I needed something kind of done to me where I was part of it, but I was also still passive. I know you guys are doing group acupuncture, and I think that's such a huge opportunity for when you're just like not feeling right, you're not feeling like you're ready to jumpstart the day, to kind of, there's a lot of science here from Chinese medicine, but to energetically kind of put balance our yin and yang and the hot and cold, and a lot of things that I didn't learn in medical school, but I know the Chinese medicine experts really appreciate and can help balance that way. So, but some of it takes experimentation, figuring out different dietary triggers, you know, figuring out when you need to move, how you need to move. Does it need to be outside? For me, being outside was a huge part of things too, which is really exciting to see how Y is moving outdoors. You know, I think that's huge for folks.
Yeah, what great point. I mean, we have thought for years that we've got this strong camping proposition, right? Kids can come into day camp or overnight camp or family camp, and or they're on a wilderness space trail for weeks and weeks through the summer. Incredible leadership progression and development. But in reality, what we know is that those services are still limited to the few. Like we don't have nature finding its way into the neighborhood, right? And so that's something that we're launching, Nature in the Neighborhood. We're expanding those cycle health events under the banner of Y Adventure Lab, and then finding ways to, in a concentric way, like, you know, right next door, a couple blocks away, you know, getting engaged, activating a park, activating a public space on behalf of the community. Maybe 5 miles out, they can go to a day camp. 50 miles out, there might be an overnight experience or some deeper immersion. And so, and looking at that programming through an equity-based lens, like that we level this, just like you talk about from a heart health perspective, how do all of our community members get access in terms of the value that nature brings? And we know we have this nature deficit disorder too. So many of young people and families who never actually have a chance to embrace, and the screens are powerful. They're sucking our kids into more and more screens.
I know.
Interesting antidote.
Yeah.
So how about coming back to the race dynamics? And it's interesting to me, like every company I'm talking to is trying to place investments around their equity and inclusion. They're trying to hire more thoughtfully and really represent the community in their workforces and on. But I'm curious if you'd talk more about where do you think we are? You know, there's certainly a dialogue that seems to be holding and persisting. Sometimes you see in these tragic events, you know, the dialogue spools up for a bit and then it fades and there's no action at a government level or at a corporate level or a community level. So what are you seeing now? Do you think that we're turning the corner? Is this a different place that we're in relative to equity?
Yeah, I'm definitely optimistic that it seems to be more of a continual part of the strategy. You know, I think having been a part of a lot of these conversations, it's sort of, you know, does equity live here? Does it live over here? And I feel like companies are starting to realize that it's a vertical and horizontal, right? That you have to have it throughout your organization strategy and be really thoughtful and where you're investing, who you're investing, how you're hiring, you know, all of these different ways. But I think we have a long way to go. And that intern that I was mentioning, her master's work, she interviewed all the health system CEOs and compared what their declarations were when George Floyd was murdered to what had happened action-wise. She was pretty excited and I think went in with sort of a, you know, did people just say things? So I think there are pockets of great work going on and companies that are doing amazing things, but, you know, we have a way to go. And then, you know, unfortunately, obviously with the recent tragedy in Buffalo, we know nationally we have a lot to do. You know, it's sort of good and bad, right? That Minneapolis was his focus that way, because it, I think, reminds us that much more. But, you know, the fact that stuff like that is still happening in 2022 is alarming.
Yeah. So to that point, you know, you've got this deep history with the Y, you're serving in a board leadership context. What do you look for from me, you know, middle-aged white dude in leadership, right? What do you want to see from leaders like me? And then also, what are you hoping the Y will do in this space?
Yeah, well, I've been really impressed with your leadership, Glenn. It's very clear, and I'm not just saying that as a board member. In fact, we're probably your hardest critics, but that you have been very thoughtful in how you're recruiting all the way through the organization. And I think perhaps most importantly at that senior level, and making sure that there is room and that there is a robust opportunity for people who haven't always been in those leadership roles. And that's been very clear. I think that to your point for, you know, middle-aged white guys, that's really huge. And I know we had an opportunity to do a roundtable with the CEO of Medtronic, and you could just tell in his thinking that that's sort of exactly what he's trying to do. He was referencing more from a gender perspective of how many women they have in VP roles at Medtronic and how proud they are of that. And just that if talent ends up leaving because you are really bringing folks in that way and people look to you as, gosh, you're getting them in these great roles, and then they're off to do what's next, I think that's great. You know, and I know that that has been sort of how the Y has served in a good way, that you've let people lead and they've gone on to even larger titles. And I think that's really exciting. So I think that's a big piece. And then I think, you know, again, to what you're doing strategy-wise, thinking about where and how we show up as the YMCA, I think that's huge. Thinking differently, not always brick and mortar, but how we have some type of presence, programs, opportunities, et cetera, in communities that haven't always had as many opportunities. But that's kind of who the Y has always been. So it's, but I think it's great to see an ongoing emphasis, and the way that you're listening to the front line of employees too, because right, they're the ones who are going to kind of tell the story of how they feel in the organization, which is huge.
Yeah, appreciate that. Well, coming to the end here, and it's been such a joy for me to spend time with you in this context. And you are such an amazing leader, Courtney. Would you share? I mean, this has been a tough couple of years for anybody in leadership, anybody in our communities, through the pandemic, through the racial and social justice challenges. What brings you hope amidst all of this challenge?
Yes. I was excited for this question because I feel like I have a great answer that happens to be Y-centric, but only because genuinely it is. But I had the opportunity. So I live in Edina. Edina just had some really bad publicity about some videos all the way up nationally that had gone out. And the Y, Hedy Wells and her team came in to have an opportunity for conversation in Edina. And I have to be honest that after that, with only one child on earth, as I like to say, I thought about, I have lots of opportunities for schools, and is Edina the right place for me based on some of the things I'm hearing? And so we went into this evening, and they were hoping for about 30 people, 300 showed up. And from start to finish, it was just such an incredible event. And I've been in so many different conversations around equity, you know, at the state level with the Department of Health, tons within the health systems, lots with the Y, but I've never been to one that felt like this. And the biggest thing that left me hopeful was at the very end, there was the opportunity for people to share kind of what your table had come up with. And totally organically, the youth started to speak, and a sixth grade boy of color got up, first one of anybody who happens to be the same age as my son. So I was very impressed that this this young guy was speaking, and basically painted this picture of what an inclusive community looks like. And it was so beautiful. And what was fascinating, and you know, basically everybody was crying there, was that there weren't any of the isms discussed. You know, there wasn't specifically calling out racism or sexism or whatever. And I think the youth look at it in ways that we've never thought, and they have words that we haven't even thought of to describe it. And very organically after that, a bunch of other Edina students spoke up. And I was so proud to live here. And that's not always how I feel, recognizing that, you know, Edina has a lot of resources that North Minneapolis doesn't. And our superintendent is a woman of color. And I was so proud of the way, just knowing that she's at the helm and is a leader. And I was so proud of how the Y led. And it was just such a great opportunity. So I want to be clear, I'm not done with my work and my age, and I'm not kind of leaving it on the shoulders of the next generation at all. But I'm very hopeful that this group is growing up this way. They're not kind of learning it the first time like some of us have been. And so I think I think that the future is bright, and I really I'm optimistic that we're going to turn the page on a lot of what we see.
I love that optimism. And I agree. I think our young people are, you know, as they are digitally native, they're also native to a different social equity in our community. And I'm seeing that from my children and their pals as well. And so we can be hopeful. And Courtney, you bring me hope too. You are a leader for good. And I'm so grateful for the time. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Glenn.
Thank you for joining us for Conversations On, where the YMCA of the North engages with local and national leaders, helping to inspire you.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And you're seeing exactly
why it's not coming from those guys?
Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos.
Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.